Hi, Jim here. Today is July 7th, 2024, and this morning at GCA we began a new series. Unfortunately, there was a glitch in the recording so that my wireless lavalier microphone was not recorded. So, I'm sitting here alone in my office, fired up the microphone, and am going to reteach the information that I taught this morning. Now, the good news about that is this sermon is largely informational. This is the groundwork stuff that we need to know in order to understand where we're going in this series. The downside of it is when I don't have eyes to look into, I don't have the same emotional level, nor do I get quite as preachy, which may be a benefit or a deficit, you decide. But I didn't want to continue this series without including this introductory material, because not only did we lay the foundation, but we also went into the beginning of the books of Luke and John. So, what is this series? Well, this series that we're starting today and that will go on for as long as it takes is basically a harmonization of the four Gospels. We have taught our way through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the past, but we concentrated on that particular book when we were going through that book. A harmonization of the Gospels is comparing all four of them, looking at the information that is unique to each of them individually, and looking at the places where they agree. So, let's start at the start. Even though we call the first four books of the New Testament the Gospels, or the Gospel according to Matthew, or the Gospel according to John, that word Gospel, euangelion, is used in a variety of ways in the New Testament. For instance, Jesus talks about the gospel of the kingdom. And all that euangelion means is good news. And that makes sense. Jesus was talking about the good news concerning the kingdom. After all, the king of Israel was there among Israel, and that's good news for the kingdom promises. Or Paul, in his letters, a couple of times uses the phrase, according to my gospel. And what he's saying is, in accordance with the things that I am preaching to you, that I am teaching you, those things that I received from Christ, then you should behave or you should react in accordance with the gospel, this gospel that I am preaching. So when you put those ideas together, what you see is that the gospel really encompasses the whole of the New Testament. All of the information about Jesus, starting with his birth and his death and his resurrection, as well as all of the doctrinal stuff, the good news about sovereign election, or about getting to heaven on the basis of Jesus' merit and not our own, that's all really good news. So, the whole of the New Testament comprises the gospel story. Now, when we're reading the first book of the New Testament, which is the Gospel according to Matthew, historically, we are right at the end of what is known as the silent period. There were 400 years there where God was essentially quiet. He had finished speaking to Malachi, the last book of the Old Testament, and then there were no prophets in Israel for 400 years. But then the gospel writers tell the story of John the Baptist, and there's a prophet in Israel again, and he is announcing the chief prophet, Jesus himself. And Jesus comes to the earth and he speaks, and so finally, after a prolonged period, God is speaking again among his people. And that's one of the essential elements of the four Gospels. But now, why are there four Gospels? Sometimes critics of the Bible like to say that because the four Gospels occasionally appear to contradict one another or not get the information exactly the same, they say, well, that's evidence then that the Gospels or the Bible cannot be trusted because even the eyewitnesses can't seem to get their stories straight. But let's be honest, if there were four Gospels and they all four said the exact same thing, the exact same way, then we would conclude that they were simply copying off each other or that they had conspired to tell this particular story this particular way. But the fact that there are four of them by four different individuals provides us with four different aspects of Jesus' ministry, his life and his death and his resurrection. And we see that from four different vantage points. Four different people who actually were alive during the time that Jesus was and who were able to recount these events. When we're talking about Matthew, when we're talking about Mark, when we're talking about John, we're talking about eyewitnesses. And in a court of law, you can't get better testimony than an eyewitness. And the reason for the variations that we see among the four writers is that they are all individual personalities with individual memories who want to emphasize particular stories about Jesus, particular things he did. For instance, Mark, the shortest of the four Gospels, Mark loves the word immediately. Mark's like a man of action. He tells his story and then keeps saying, and then immediately this happened, and immediately that happened, concentrating then on the things that Jesus did. John, meanwhile, concentrates on the things that Jesus said, because he's trying to prove a completely different point than Mark is trying to prove. Now, before we continue with the distinctions and the necessities of the four Gospels, I need to make a real important theological and literary point. Because as we're going through the Gospel accounts, we're going to see and read things that Jesus said that we have to determine, is he saying that to us? Does it apply to us? Is it merely there to teach us, or are we to take it all to heart because, after all, it's in the red letters, that stuff that Jesus said? Our Bible is divided into two large literary sections. We call them the Old Testament and the New Testament. But in the Old Testament, we see what Paul refers to as the Old Covenant, which is the covenant that God formed with Israel, in particular at Mount Sinai, when he took them out of the land of Egypt. But then there is also something in Jeremiah called the New Covenant. Well, that New Covenant went into effect, according to the writer of Hebrews, when Jesus died. He argues that a testament is not in effect until the death of the testator. So, the gospel writers, two of them start with the birth of Jesus. They all four concentrate on the ministry of Jesus, a 3.5-year period, basically. They all talk about his death, his burial, his resurrection, and that would be the event that brings about the inception of the new covenant. Which means that a great deal of the information that we read in the four Gospels is actually occurring while the old covenant is still in effect. And that's important to remember, because some of the things that Jesus says while the old covenant is still in effect are things that he is not saying directly to us. He is not applying it directly to us, and we have to be able to differentiate between those things that apply directly to us, 21st century Gentile believers, and the things that he was saying in particular to people who were still under the old covenant. For instance, when talking to the Pharisees who were still under the covenant of Moses, he talked to them about tithing and said, "This you should have done." But if you take that same phraseology and apply it to the new covenant church, well, then you're taking an old covenant concept and importing it into the new covenant. Or when Jesus was talking to the Pharisees and he said, "You are whitewashed sepulchers. You look all clean and white on the outside, but inside you're all dead men's bones and all uncleanness." Okay, Jesus actually said that. It's in the red letters. But did he mean that for every one of the redeemed who he bought with his own blood when he paid the sin price for all of them? Well, no, of course not. Jesus said it and meant it to particular people who were still under the old covenant, and he was condemning them for their lack of faith in him. And we have to be able to make those distinctions as we go through these four gospels in order to understand what is meant for us. All of it is for our teaching. All of it is for our edification. Not all of it is imposed on our conscience. And that's important to remember. The distinction between New Testament, Old Testament, New Covenant, Old Covenant. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, there are four Gospels. Three of them are referred to as what we call the Synoptic Gospels. That's Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Synoptic is just a combination of two words, optics, which has to do with seeing or vision. You visit an optometrist, and S-Y-N, that prefix is the same as our modern word synergy, which is working together. So synoptic means seeing things the same way, because Matthew, Mark, and Luke oftentimes recite the same events, the same information, oftentimes in very much the same way. So they are seeing things the same way. They are the synoptic gospels. But then there is the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John, as I said, concentrates more on what Jesus said than what he did, because John has a completely other intention for why he's writing. In fact, John oftentimes assumes that you have read and that you are familiar with one or all of the previous synoptic gospels. John was the last of the four to write, and so he says things in passing like, "That was before John was beheaded." He doesn't write anything about John the Baptist being beheaded, but he assumes you would know that from reading it in the synoptic gospels, so he can just mention it and keep going. So once again, this is an indication that the four Gospels work together as a unit, and they sort of piggyback off one another. And they were writing to different audiences. For instance, Matthew's purpose in writing, based on everything that he said and how often he quotes from the Old Testament and uses that as support to make his case, he is arguing that Jesus of Nazareth, that particular person from Nazareth of all places, I mean, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Little kind of backwater town. But Jesus of Nazareth, he argues, is the Messiah, the long-awaited King of Israel. And so he is using Scripture in order to support his argument that Jesus is the long-awaited king. Mark, meanwhile, is concentrating on what Isaiah calls a suffering servant. Isaiah writes about the fact that God was going to send a Messiah who was also going to suffer and die as a sin sacrifice. Mark's emphasis seems to be that Jesus was that sufficient sin sacrifice, and that he suffered because God was pouring out our sin debt on him. And then Luke is interesting. Matthew, Mark, and John are all apostles of Jesus. Luke is a Gentile, and he's writing to a Gentile, Theophilus, very Greek name. And at the beginning of his letter, he explains his purpose in writing, and he admits that others have written about Jesus, but that he has interviewed the eyewitnesses. He has assembled all of this information, and he's trying to put it in a proper order so that Theophilus can understand the details of what it is he has come to believe. Now, Luke was a longtime companion of the Apostle Paul. They traveled extensively together, which is why Luke was able to write the book of Acts. He wrote about the Acts of the Apostles and primarily about Paul because he traveled with Paul, so he had insider knowledge. Along the way, he met the various apostles and apparently interviewed them in order to find out the truth of these various events and the order that they go in. Now, Luke, being a Greek, writing to a Greek, was interested in the Greek ideal of the perfect man. That's why Greek culture is responsible for the Olympiads. But also, Greek culture brings us so much philosophy and the logic of Aristotle. Because the perfect man would not only be an ideal physical specimen, but he would also be intellectually superior. Luke's purpose in writing is to demonstrate to his Greek Gentile audience that Jesus is the perfect man. He is everything you would want a man to be. Physically strong, has great physical endurance, but also able to tell us things that we couldn't possibly know if he were not to tell us. He is the perfect man. John's purpose in writing, and the reason that he emphasizes the things that Jesus said more than the things that Jesus did, is because he is proving that Jesus is the Son of God. So you've got Matthew writing, this is the Messiah to come. This is the King of the Jews. You've got Mark saying, he is also Isaiah's suffering servant. So he is the sin sacrifice for us. You've got Luke saying, he is also the ideal man. And John adds, and oh yes, he is God incarnate. And when you put those four together, you get a more complete emphasis by which you can actually truly embrace all the different aspects of who Christ is, what Christ did, and why it is that we worship Christ. Now, at this point, just let me add something that I just find interesting. In the Old Testament, there appears to be a foreshadow of the fact that there would be four Gospels, and that those four Gospels would emphasize those four aspects of Jesus. Here's what I'm talking about. In the tabernacle in the wilderness, the instructions that God gave Moses for how to build the tabernacle included a tremendous amount of detail, including what each element had to be made of and the particular colors that were to be found in the tabernacle. Those colors would be in the curtains, they'd be in the clothing of the priests, they would even be on the plate that was on the head of the high priest when he went into the Holy of Holies. So there are only four colors that are described within the tabernacle in the wilderness, and those four colors are purple and red and gold or white, and blue. And those four colors perfectly correspond with the purpose that lays behind each of the four authors of the four Gospels. For instance, Matthew was writing to say that Jesus is the Messiah, the King, And in those days and to this day, purple is considered a royal color. So purple would correspond with Matthew's gospel. Then, of course, red or scarlet, which is the color of blood, which would perfectly correlate with Mark's writing about the suffering servant. And gold is a color of perfection. It's a color of faith tried in the fire. And so that corresponds with Luke's purpose for writing in describing the perfect man. And John, writing to all believers, would write that Jesus is the Son of God, the one from the heavens, and the heavens, from earth's perspective, are blue. Again, this could be completely a coincidence, but it also exists. It's in the Bible, and I don't think it would be beyond the sovereign God of the universe to be foreshadowing the gospel stories in the tabernacle in advance. I mean, he communicates through numbers, he communicates through words, he communicates through action, he communicates through his creation, through the stars, he communicates through color. And so, if this was a form of God telling us that there were going to be four gospel accounts that emphasize four different aspects of who Jesus is, I'm fine with that. I don't think it's completely coincidental. But then, beyond that, you get to the book of Revelation. And in Revelation 4, 6 to 8, we meet these creatures that are just known as living beings. John doesn't know how to describe them. They're not like any being that we know on earth. They don't fit into any zoological category that we know of. And they are beasts with four heads. And this is what he writes about them. Starting in Revelation 4, verse 6, "And before the throne there was something like a sea of glass, like crystal, and in the center and around the throne, four living creatures full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature was like a lion, the second creature like a calf, the third creature had the face of a man, and the fourth creature was like a flying eagle. The four living creatures, each one of them having six wings, are full of eyes around and within, and day and night they do not cease to say, 'Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God, the Almighty, who was and who is and who is to come.'" Now, the particular aspect of these living creatures that I want to hone in on for just a moment is those four faces, because those four faces also appear to correlate to the four Gospels. Matthew, writing about Jesus as the coming Messiah, the King of the Jews, well, historically and to this day, especially on the banners over in Britain, you see lions used to represent royalty. That's why we call lions the king of the beasts. And so then, the face of a lion would correlate to Matthew's gospel. And then you have an ox. Oxen were used primarily as beasts of burden, but also as acceptable sacrifices. And that seems to correlate rather perfectly with Mark's description of Jesus as the suffering servant, as the ultimate sacrifice. Luke, who is writing to a Greek audience and describing the perfect man, I don't have to do a lot of stretching to say the third face that John describes is the face of a man. So there seems to be a correlation there. And finally, the face of an eagle. And because John is writing that Jesus is the heavenly one, the one that came down from the heavens, well, then it's not surprising that the eagle, the one that flies high up into the heavens, would be a corollary to what John is writing about. So, again, could be coincidence, Maybe. But we are talking about the God who is in the details, who doesn't make mistakes, who is telling the same story all the way along, which would mean that back in the book of Exodus, he used colors to describe four gospels, and in the book of Revelation, at the end of the book, he uses the living creatures with their four faces, again to validate the idea that we only need four gospels, and those four are sufficient to tell us what we need to know about Jesus. Now, historically, there are other books that refer to themselves as gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas. But those are what are known as the Gnostic writing, the Gnostic books. They don't have the pedigree that the four original Gospels have. The four original Gospels have their source in eyewitnesses. They were either there walking and talking with Jesus, or they were interviewed by Luke because they were eyewitnesses. So they have a pedigree of testimony directly from the original apostles. The Gnostic books, written later, don't have that same pedigree, and that is why the early assemblers of the New Testament, early church synods, and early assembled canons of Scripture don't include those books, because they cannot prove their pedigree. Okay, so you've got Matthew, who is writing to a Jewish audience, and he is writing about the King of the Jews. You've got Mark, who is writing to a mixture of Jews and Gentiles. Mark, by the way, was tutored by Peter. And so sometimes theologians will refer to the Gospel of Mark as being the Gospel of Peter as well. And then you have Luke, who is a Greek, writing to a Greek audience, to Theophilus in particular, and then to the larger Greek reading audience. And then you have John, who is writing to all believers about the fact that Jesus is God, as we're going to see in just a moment. The shortest of the four Gospels is the Gospel of Mark. And the Gospel of Mark is fascinating in several different ways. When we're examining the Gospels, we are looking for things that are called internal indications of truth. In other words, we're looking for evidence that these people who claim to be eyewitnesses to these really astounding events were honest, truthful men. I mean, after all, we are resting our faith and our eternal destiny on what these people wrote. So it is important that we know that they are trustworthy. And along the way, as you're looking for these internal indications of truth, you see things like Mark uses this phrase, the Son of Man, more than the other gospel writers do, even though his is the shortest of the gospels. Now, Mark is writing to both a Jewish and Greek audience. To the Jews who are reading, they understand Son of Man to be some of the most important messianic nomenclature that there is. Son of Man harkens back to Daniel, seeing one like the Son of Man approaching the Ancient of Days. But to a Gentile reading the phrase Son of Man, they think Mark is just saying, he's the son of a man, you know, like the rest of us. We all have earthly fathers. We are all sons of men. So actually, Mark is kind of hurting his story with Gentiles by using the phrase son of man. And if he were a liar, if he was trying to sell a bill of goods to people, I mean, if he had followed Jesus for 3.5 years and then Jesus died and then stayed dead, well, then they've backed the wrong horse. And maybe they all got together and said, look, guys, here's what we got to do. We got to save face on this one. So let's just say that he rose again. Yeah, that's it. That's what we're going with. He rose again. He's not really dead. He's sitting at the right hand of God, and he's still God, and he's coming again. None of which is true if he did not get up out of the grave. So it is important when talking about the resurrection that we are able to prove that these men were truth tellers and that they weren't just making this story up. And Mark uses the phrase Son of Man to an audience that isn't going to understand its Jewish heritage and importance. And nevertheless, he uses that phrase repeatedly because that's what Jesus said. So Mark was willing to even risk hurting his story to the Gentile audience in order to tell the truth. It is an internal indication of the accuracy of what Mark wrote. So by putting these all together, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and by looking at them in order, in other words, we're going to go through them chronologically as they are laying out similar and dissimilar events. We're going to harmonize these four Gospels. And yes, it's going to take some time, but that's what we're setting out to do. We need all four Gospels in order to get a truly well-rounded understanding of who Jesus was, what Jesus did, and what Jesus said. And I think at the end of all this, and I hope along the way as well, our faith is going to be built up as we see confidently that these four men brought us the very truth, which is why we can call it the good news of Jesus Christ. So, where are we going to begin this journey? Let's begin in the book of Luke, because I am going to be using the book of Luke as our basic outline. After all, Luke is about to tell us that he is trying to set these things in order. So, since we have to have some kind of structure to this study, we're going to use Luke as sort of our guide and then combine the things that Matthew and Mark and John add to Luke's story. And we're going to compare and we're going to contrast, and we're not going to pull punches. And if there are variations, we're going to say there are variations. But I think what you're going to find is, in the end, those variations don't really add up to much of anything anyway. All right, the Gospel according to Luke, we're really just going to read the first four verses to kind of set the stage. He writes, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us." Okay, so right away Luke is saying, we are eyewitnesses to this stuff. And I'm talking to the other eyewitnesses. These are the things that I have seen. I mean, remember, Luke did travel with Paul. He did see miracles at the hands of Paul. And then he heard Paul repeatedly declare the things that had happened to him. So these are the things that occurred and were accomplished among the apostles. And others have undertaken to compile an account of those things. But verse 2 says, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, they have handed these things down to us. So again, Luke is saying, I interviewed people. I went and checked with the original sources. The end result then being a trustworthy accounting of what I actually experienced, what actually happened among us. So verse 3, it seemed fitting to me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning. That means from the beginning of Christ's life, from the beginning of Christ's ministry. I have investigated everything carefully from the beginning to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you might know the exact truth about the things you have been taught. So Theophilus is apparently a believer. He has heard the gospel, but he doesn't know the full story of Jesus or how this faith came about. Luke then has interviewed the eyewitnesses. He knows the original accounts, so he is able to recite it all for Theophilus. And I'm certainly happy that he did, because that's why we now have access to what is called the Gospel of Luke. Luke is then going to go into the background, the birth of John the Baptist, and of Jesus himself. Sometimes people get the impression that Jesus began at his incarnation, that when he appeared in the belly of Mary, a little Jewish virgin, that that was the beginning of the Jesus story. But it's not. Jesus pre-existed those events by a long shot. And that's important, again, to remember theologically. There are theologies and teachings out there that will tell you that Jesus was a created being. Mormonism, for instance, teaches that. But the Bible actually argues that Jesus existed long before his appearance in his mother's womb. For instance, in the Old Testament, there are several things that are referred to as Christophanies. What that means is a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ here on planet Earth. Theologians argue that the angel that wrestled with Jacob and put his hip out of joint was actually Christ. Several times in the Old Testament, we read about the angel of the Lord, which just means the messenger of the Lord. And many of those appearances of the angel of the Lord include events or language that is far beyond human or even angelic capacity. And so people argue that that is Jesus himself in a pre-incarnate state appearing over the course of the Old Testament. In the book of Genesis, we read about Melchizedek, a rather mysterious character who is, by definition, Prince of Peace. He is the King of Salem, and Abraham tithes to him. The writer of Hebrews appears to be making the argument that that was a Christophany. I don't have time to go into the details right here and now, but from a theological standpoint, because Jesus is said to be a priest after the order of Melchizedek rather than the line of Levi, I think we could safely argue that only Jesus himself has the kind of spiritual authority and godlikeness to establish his own priesthood. I mean, after all, what man could establish the priesthood that Jesus is the fulfillment of? Anyway, that may be a Christophany. So in the Old Testament, there are several indications that Jesus did not begin in the womb of Mary. He lived, he existed well before that, and appeared several times before that. But that's not the beginning of Jesus. The beginning of Jesus is he doesn't have a beginning. The beginning of Jesus is that he has coexisted with God as long as God has existed. So let's turn to John 1. Because John is going to make that very argument. John begins his gospel with the words, "in the beginning." Now, to any Jewish reader, they would automatically know that the words, "in the beginning," hearken all the way back to the beginning of the book of Genesis. And they would know that in the beginning, God made heaven and earth. That's how the whole Bible begins. In the beginning, God made the heavens and the earth. But then John argues that Jesus himself was there at that beginning, and that he was the speaking agency through which everything was made. In other words, in the book of Genesis, when we read that God said, "Let there be light," the speaking agency of the triunity of the Godhead, Jesus himself, he was the Logos, the spoken word that said, "Let there be light." John has such a very, very high Christology that he places Christ right there at the very beginning of all creation, proving that Jesus pre-exists everything. Here's what he writes. John 1:1. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God. Now, this is really important. John does something really impressive with his prepositions here. First, he says, at the beginning, when God created everything, that Jesus so pre-existed that he was with God, Theos, in the creation of everything. But not only was he with Theos, he was Theos. He was God. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was Theos. And just so you don't miss what he's saying, he then says, and he, the Logos, was in the beginning with Theos. He was right there at the very beginning. When you open the Bible and you read Genesis 1, that's Jesus. He's right there. Yes, the Father exists. Yes, the Father is the Creator God. But Jesus was right there, participant in it all. In fact, he spoke all these things into existence because he was both with God and he was God. All things came into being by him. And apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. That's pretty all-inclusive. That means absolutely everything. There's nothing you can name that has existence that doesn't exist because he decided it would exist. All the big stuff, all the enormous stuff, all the galactic stuff, all the universe stuff, all the little cells, all the little atoms, every little virus, every good thing that comes into your life, every good possession, everything that you see, every bad thing that enters into your life, all of this was created and spoken into being by the eternal Godhead working in its triunity. And that's so important, what John is saying here, because his image of Jesus was more than just, yes, he's king of Israel. Yes, that's true. Yes, he's the king of the Jews. Yes. Yes, he was the one born in Nazareth. All true. And yes, he was the suffering servant. Yes, he was the perfect sin sacrifice who paid our debt to God. True. And yes, he was the perfect man. He is the culmination of what humanity can be. So much so that when we receive our eternal new bodies, they will be like Christ. He is the prototype, if you will, of what eternal perfect humanity is. And John agrees. Yeah, all true, all good. But he's more than that. If you limit yourself to just that, you don't have a full, complete comprehension of who Jesus is. And this is really theologically where so much rubber hits the road, because there are theologies and teachings out there that stop short of saying Jesus is, in his fullness, completely and utterly God, and deserves to be both reckoned as God and worshiped as God. But he is the one who was with God, who created all things, and nothing that was created without him. That's a very high Christology, a very high understanding of who Jesus is. In him was life. Again, in the book of Genesis, we read that God breathed into the nostrils of Adam, and he became a living soul. So we credit God with doing that. And yet it was and is Christ, according to John, who is the very essence of life. He is ever living, and he is able to give life at will. Terrestrial life, eternal life, it all finds its starting point in Jesus Christ. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. Again, really interesting concept. I mean, John is just a couple verses into his letter here, and he's laying out these big, heavy theological concepts. If Jesus was the light of men, that tells you that men are naturally in darkness. They may be existing here on the planet, but if they don't have any spiritual insight, then they're still in the darkness. They are still, as Paul would say, dead in their sins and trespasses. They are walking around looking as if they are alive, but they are actually spiritually, morally, eternally dead. They have to be enlightened. They have to be quickened and taken from their dead darkness to light. They have to be born again. They have to be regenerated. And the only way that can happen is for the light that is Jesus Christ to enter a man, to enlighten that man. He is the source of all eternal enlightenment. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shines in the darkness. I think that darkness includes not only all the people of the planet, but the world itself. When Jesus came to the planet, the world was dark, a very dark place, and continues to exist in so much of the world in this kind of spiritual darkness, the inability to see truth, the inability to see what is genuinely, eternally factual. And yet he, the true light, came into that darkness. That's an astounding incarnation. That Jesus, the ever-living one, took on human flesh in order to join us down here in this darkness. But even though he was here in the darkness, he remained light. Because not only does John say, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. The darkness did not comprehend the light. Now, that particular Greek word there is rendered a few different ways. One of the concepts behind it is that the darkness of this world was not sufficient to snuff out or envelop or quench that light. The eternal light of Jesus was not in any way reduced or lessened or hampered or restricted by the darkness of men. He remained the light of the world. Skip down to verse 9, and we read, there was the true light, which, coming into the world, enlightens every man. Now, not every man who ever lived, obviously, has that enlightenment. Some men remain as brute beasts and remain in their darkness and their sin, proven by the fact that the judgment of God does exist. But to every man who is actually enlightened, to anybody who actually comes to the knowledge of Jesus Christ and salvation through his finished sacrifice, you have come to that realization because the one who is the light has enlightened you. And everybody who stands in that enlightened state does so because he is the true light who came into the world. He is the one who enlightens men. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. and the world did not know him. That's speaking of more than just an intellectual acknowledgement of him, although that's certainly true. There are plenty of people on the planet, were then and are now, who don't know Jesus, who don't comprehend anything about Jesus, who remain in their darkness. But actually, the word know here means much more than that. It's kind of like when Jesus said that some will say to him, "Lord, Lord," and he will say to them, "Depart from me, I never knew you." That's speaking of an intimacy of relationship that goes far beyond just intellectual acknowledgement. And the world, the cosmos, the physical world itself, and all the people in the world were all created by him, and he existed in among his creation. The world was made by him, and he was in the world, and yet the world did not have intimacy of relationship with him. He remained separate. He remained God. He remained unique to all of humanity. Verse 11 says, he came to his own. That's speaking particularly of the tribe of Judah. He came to the Jews. He was a Jew all the way back in the book of Genesis, when Jacob leaned on his staff with his very dim eyes and was very close to death. He spoke prophecies about each of his 12 sons and what would become of them in the future, and he designated Judah as the tribe through which the Lion of Judah was going to come. Shiloh would come through Judah. So there's no question that Jesus himself, after his physical genealogy here on the planet, was a Jew. And he came to other Jews, because after all, the God of the Old Testament, the God of the Bible, refers to himself repeatedly as the God of Israel. The same way that pretty much every nation, every people group, every tribe has their own gods. Gods who may not be able to actually do anything for them, but they would designate gods, and oftentimes they had a whole plethora of gods who had individual responsibilities. This is the god of plants. This is the god of bugs. This is the god of crocodiles or cats. But that was the uniqueness of the God of Israel. The God of that people group was the God who defined himself as the maker of heaven and earth, the only God who truly is, the one who could say, "You'll have no other gods before me. I am the one and only self-existent God. I am because I am." That is the particular God who belongs to Israel. And then that God took on human form and came and dwelt not only among Israel, but among the particular tribe into which he was born. He was born among the Judahites, and verse 11 says, he came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. They rejected him. They killed him. But that was all according to the divine plan of God. In the book of Acts, we read that Herod and Pontius Pilate and the Jews and the Gentiles were gathered together at Jerusalem to do whatever God's hand had predetermined to be done. So even their unbelief was according to an absolutely sovereign God, because he had to end up on a cross, and he had to end up on a cross on a particular Passover. And so God used the unbelief of the Jews in order to accomplish the redemption of all of his chosen people since before the foundation of the world. All that being said, the astounding reality of what John writes is just overwhelming, that the one who was with God and the one who is God, the one who spoke all things into existence, the one without whom nothing was made that was made, that very one took on human flesh and came to the planet and dwelt in his creation, and yet the vast majority of his creation rejected him, did not accept him or receive him or have faith in him. And in fact, much of his creation hated him to the point of wanting to eliminate him. And yet he is the only perfect one, the only good one, the only one in whom light and life reside, and men, in their unbelievable darkness, rejected such a one. That's how John starts his letter, with the eternality of Christ. And then in verse 12, we read this very good piece of news. But as many as did receive him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. Now, by the way, that also implies that mankind, by their natural state, are not children of God. Yes, they are all God's creation. Yes, it can be argued, and is argued in the New Testament, that they are born in the image of God. But they are not children of God. They are not adopted into the family of God. They don't have the right to call God their father. But unlike the vast majority of the Jews who rejected Jesus, there were also some who did receive him. But the reason they received him is not because of them. It's not because they had the right bloodline, because they were Jews. It's not because they were the high and the mighty. Or it's not because they were the impoverished. It's not because they were born into the right family. It's not because someone else decided that they should go to heaven and either talked them into it or prayed them into heaven. And in fact, it's not because they chose. It's not because they decided. It wasn't according to their decision to be saved by Jesus. As many as received him, to them he gave the astounding privilege, the right, the authority to become children of God. Unlike the rest of the world that are not children of God, they become children of God because Christ Jesus gave them the right to become children of God, even to those who believe in his name. The result of Christ enlightening you, the result of Christ giving you everlasting life, is that he gives you the right based on his own authority so that you can become children of God. And the way that happens is that faith in Jesus Christ takes up residence in you. By the Holy Spirit of God, you come to recognize both the importance and the eternality of Christ. You recognize that he is perfect man, that he is suffering servant, that he is King of the Jews. But you recognize, importantly, that he is eternal God and therefore can be your eternal Savior. You will have faith in him, in his name, in his authority, in his finished work. Now, how did you come to that point? How did you come to that conclusion? John is now going to eliminate all of the common ways that men think they come to faith in Jesus. In fact, the common ways that so much of the church preaches come to faith in Jesus. John is going to eliminate all of that because he is teaching the absolute authority and sovereignty of Jesus Christ, who is God. Those people were born out of their dead state. Those people were enlightened by Christ. But they were born not of blood. That means they didn't have the right heritage. Jew or Gentile, as I said, rich or poor, male or female. It doesn't matter what tribe you came from. It doesn't matter what portion of society you came from. It is not your bloodline, your heritage, or your genealogy that made you a child of God. You were made a child of God because Jesus Christ gave you the right to become a child of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, It's not because somebody prayed you into heaven. It's not because you were born into a family of believers. It's not because people who love you just really, really wanted to see you saved. So it's not of your blood. It's not of the will of men, of mankind, but importantly, nor of the will of man. There's no man, including yourself, who has the willpower to stir himself up to seek God. You become a child of God. You come to faith in Jesus Christ because the one who is the eternal Logos, through his authority and his power and his name and his sacrifice and his perfection, he gives you the astounding gift of being a child of God. He gets all the credit and you don't get any of it. As a consequence, he gets all the glory and you don't get any of it. So whose will is it that resulted in the salvation of particular people, even though most of the dark world doesn't comprehend Jesus or the light that he brought to the earth? How does that happen? Well, they were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. It is the will of God, the eternal sovereign God, who's sitting on his throne right now doing whatever pleases him. He created everything, he sustains everything, and he determines who it is that's going to be saved eternally. That's the way that John begins his gospel, with deep, far-reaching, eternal theology and a very, very high Christology. Next week, we're going to look at Luke's account of a baby in a manger, the perfect man. In the course of that story, we're going to hear about Magi who come to worship the King of the Jews, Matthew's story. But we have to remember that those events are predated by the eternal Logos, who eternally is God, who eternally is working out his plan right here, right now. And that is why people to this very day are coming to faith in Jesus Christ. It takes all four Gospels to understand all of that. And my intention is, as we go through these four Gospels, we will continue to increase our knowledge of the things Jesus said, the things that Jesus did, and why he was able to say and do these things. Along the way, I hope to prove that these were honest men telling honest accounts of what they actually saw, heard, and experienced. And that is why we have confidence in Christ Jesus to this very day. And that, collectively, is the gospel.